Today's Taisho will be on case 151 in the koan collection known as Entangling Vines. Case 151 is entitled Yang Shan Smashes a Mirror. When Yang Shan Weiji was residing at Dongping, a letter and a mirror arrived from Guishan Lingyu. Yang Shan ascended the high seat and received the letter. Then holding up the mirror, he addressed the assembly. Monks, this mirror comes from Guishan. Tell me, is it Guishan's mirror or is it mine? If you say it's mine, still it was sent by Guishan. If you say it's Guishan, still it's here in my hands. If you can say something, I'll spare the mirror. If you can't, I'll smash it. He repeated this three times, but no one in the assembly responded. The master then smashed the mirror. Wu Zhu Shijie answered in place of the assembly when he heard the story. I would have said, Master, please try to explain your meaning a bit more clearly. Then grabbed the mirror and shattered it myself. So today is the first day of our winter session, and everybody did a wonderful job this morning sitting. Everybody was really sitting deeply. The great Japanese Zen master Dogen described Zen this way. He said, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all things, or the 10,000 things. So, in a way, that's a bit like the process at a sesshin. When we come to sesshin, we basically close ourselves off from everything else. And often, when people do this at first, there's kind of intensification of self-awareness. We say, I am alone with my thoughts. I'm alone with my thoughts. Fortunately, in Sashin, you're alone with others, right? So we're all very careful to respect other people's privacy. We don't talk and we don't look at them in the eye, so they can be processing. They can be working through their obstacles. But, one of the effects of this is that early in the sesshin, it's a little bit like suddenly being alone with your thoughts. And that's difficult for some people. There are people who are really, who really don't want to be alone with their thoughts. They keep very busy. And when they are alone with their thoughts, it's difficult for them to deal with. I have definitely known people in my life who respond to inner turmoil by getting up and cleaning the house or doing some other kind of task, and after a while they leave behind, or think they leave behind, what was bothering them. So part of Zen practice is sort of day one practice is being a bit alone with your thoughts, And as you're sitting on the cushion, things are going to come up. Maybe you're still thinking about events from the time just before you came to sesshin. Perhaps you're thinking about something issue at work. A lot of people have a hard time freeing themselves and coming to sesshin because so much is going on in their lives. And sometimes you just have to escape, right? It's like, I can remember when I was in graduate school, my professor heard that I was doing Zen, and he actually thought that was terrible. He said, that's taking you away from your research, And he was, when I think he knew I would be going to Sesshin, so he'd sort of give me extra things to do, you know, and I would just sort of have to close the book and run and come to Sesshin. So part of Zen practice is being along with our thoughts, but, you know, by around a day two or day three, there's going to be this change. It's definitely the case that being along with the thoughts, it feels very real. Being along with your thoughts feels very real. Studying the self feels very real. The self is a complicated thing. It's complicated. Last night, I was talking about the fact that, there's the consciousness, our consciousness has many components to it, many parts, you could say. We have a faculty of seeing and a faculty of hearing, tasting, touch, smell. You know, we have our five senses. We also have a wonderful reflective or analytical capacity, you know. And then there's this other part of our mind which is always saying me, 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 or I am, I am, I am. And, early Buddhists thought that the problem was the world, you know. So early Buddhists, you know, had sort of like an ambivalent attitude towards reality. You know, a little bit like some other religions also tend to look at the world as like a fallen world or a bad place, right? And if you read like early Buddhist literature, they often talk about what are called taints or defilements. So, if you make a delicious meal and you eat it and you enjoy it, some of these early Buddhists thought of that as like getting trapped, right? You're defiling yourself by being attached to, say, a piece of pumpkin pie. That was how they understood things. But later Buddhists said, there's no end to that, you know. You don't have to eat pumpkin pie if you enjoy it, you know. But, you know, you might be eating things you don't enjoy, and then accidentally you might actually enjoy it, you know. And then where would you be, you know? You'd be defiled again. So there's something wrong with that mentality, you know. Later Buddhists had a better understanding of the problem. Basically there's nothing wrong with listening to music. You know, I myself really love music, and one of my teachers, Webb, was a musician, and he loved to play the piano. I think when he played the piano, he would enter into deep samadhi, you know. In fact, after one of our sesshins, had a place where we could reliably have sesshin, we used to rent different places in the Seattle area. And one of the places we rented was a Catholic seminary. And in one of the rooms there was a grand piano. And at the end of the sesshin, when we were packing up to go, there was just this incredible, I heard this incredible music, and I went in and Webb was just playing it, you know, just rolling across the keyboards in the most beautiful way. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with enjoying beautiful music. There's nothing wrong, actually, if you like pumpkin pie, please, it's okay. You know, you can have a piece of pumpkin pie. There's really nothing wrong with life, you know, living life, having six senses, having five senses, and there's nothing wrong with actually reading books and thinking. You know, none of those things are actually a problem. You know, the problem is that we get trapped in this I am mentality. You know, that's very difficult to get out of because we build we build this image of ourselves over time, and it becomes kind of like a habitual, it becomes a sort of like a mental tic or a habit. It's definitely good that we can say, I am. There's something good about that, right? That you can say, I am, or me. Even me is actually kind of a good thing. I was reading this book by a primatologist, and she was saying that she was shocked when she was studying chimpanzees, because she said, you know, chimpanzees are so human-like. And she said, but one day she saw her band of chimpanzees grab a little monkey. And when she saw the chimpanzees grab a little monkey, she thought they were going to, cradle the little monkey in their arms and take care of it, because after all, it's another simian, just like us. You know, we're all simians here. But actually, she said that the chimpanzees actually, basically treated the little monkey as food. And they didn't even kill it properly. They started eating it while it was still alive. And it was quite, you know, she said she was just like mortified, right? And she said, you know, she said, I could identify with the monkey. You know, I could say to the monkey, you are like me. You know, you are like me. But the chimps couldn't do it. They did not look at that monkey and say, you are like me. They looked at the monkey and said, you are food, you know. And they had no problem, you know, we would say being astonishingly cruel and unkind. They didn't really have the capacity to look at this animal and say, you are like me. You know, so being able to say me is a good thing, because it allows us to be able to say, you are like me. You know, and I think that's really like the basis of compassion, right? You know, being able to see somebody else suffering and to say, oh, your suffering is like my suffering, you know, that's really wonderful. And I hope we develop even a stronger identification, you know, as people and as a culture, you know. So this ability to say me, this ability to say I, is really a great, wonderful thing. You know, without it, we would probably be like those chimpanzees. You know, we would be unable to empathize with the suffering of, say, a little monkey or a cat. You know, I have a couple of cats, and I'm totally convinced that they are human beings, you know. One of my cats, it follows me everywhere. It sleeps on top of me. When I go downstairs to get a snack, it comes down and gets a snack with me. I ask it what it wants. It lets me know, you know. So I don't know if the cat has the traits. I treat the cat like a person. And the cat seems to fill the role very well, you know. And I love my cat, you know. I don't know if the cat really is all the things I think it is. And it's not a big problem for me. I really don't care. I really enjoy the cat. Maybe it has these things and maybe it doesn't. But it's wonderful to love my cat, you know. That's a great gift. And I think it comes from being able to say, my cat is like me, you know. But it's complicated because... this ability to say me, this ability to say I, which allows us to identify with other creatures and with each other, right? I mean, one of the reasons, you know, I think people can be so generous and kind is because in a way they're identifying with the other person so fully. You know, you'll hear people say, these people, you know, like refugees, these are our brothers, you know, that, or these are our sisters, and that resonates, they're like me, you know, that are like me. So that's a very good thing. But on the other hand, you know, this capacity that we have, this hard wiring or whatever it is, gets us in a lot of trouble too, right? Because we can become very much prisoners of this same like ability, you know. So I've told this story many times before, but when I was a child, I had a very a good relationship with my mother for a long time, and she was very kind to me and a little bit like indulgent, you know, and she would sort of always praise me, and then I began to watch television and movies, and I remember seeing a movie where this was an old movie, like from maybe like the 1940s, in the movie, one of the characters said he was making fun of English people, and he was leaving the room, and he said, I think it might have even been Clark Gable, if you know who Clark Gable is, very big movie star. But anyway, he said, pip pip, cheerio, and all that crap. And I watched this on a movie, and I thought, oh my God, you know, he is so witty, he is so clever, and everybody in the movie laughed. So anyway, my parents were had some friends over to the house, and they were entertaining their friends, and I came in from my bedroom, and they were all being friendly to me. All the adults were being friendly to me, and then it was my time to leave, and I turned and I said, "Well, pip pip, cheerio, and all that crap." And my mother's face, it was just like, she scolded me in front of everybody, and she said, "I don't know where he heard that word." Of course, she had used it many times, you know. But, you know, that's actually like, I think that's actually like a complex situation, you know, because, you know, I think my mother helped me to imagine myself, you know. So when my mother would look at me, I felt real to myself. And I was always happy to be noticed by my mother. And when she noticed me, I think I felt more real to myself. And I definitely think that when I wasn't around my mother, I felt less real to myself, you know. I sort of felt like more like a ghost, you know. So, you know, the happiest times in my early childhood were being around my mother, you know, she would look at me and I would feel real. And then when I was outside playing with other kids, I wasn't really sure who I was, you know, because not all the kids would look at me with that loving look or that approving look. You know, some kids we were living in Baltimore. It was a pretty tough neighborhood. So, you know, some kids were quite aggressive and even hostile, you know. So, I liked to come home and be safe and be with my mother because she would look at me with these loving eyes and I would feel stable in myself. Everybody wants that experience, I think. You know, we want to be liked. We want people to look at us with loving eyes and say, "You are real," or "You are valuable," you know. And I think this is a deep human drive. And when we don't get it, I do think we wonder, who are we, you know? This desire to be a real self comes from wanting to be looked at by others or approved of by others. And this is a human, this is a good thing to a point, you know. But on the other hand, you know, we can become very confused about who we are, And we can develop like an unhealthy relationship to other people and to ourselves. You know, when I said pip pip cheerio and all that crap, you know, I misjudged my audience. You know, I thought they were all going to laugh and say, "Oh, what a delightfully suave little kid you are," you know. And instead, they looked like I had gone to the bathroom on the floor. Remember just feeling this deep sense of embarrassment, you know, or shame. And I had other experiences like that too, you know. When I was a kid, there was a fad or a trend when I was a kid. People used to have special lunch boxes. And the lunch boxes had on the outside of the box your favorite TV show. My favorite TV show when I was a kid was a mysterious masked man called Zorro, who was a liberator in California in the colonial period, and he would ride around on a black horse and he had a mask and nobody could catch him, and he was a master swordsman. And he was such a great swordsman that when he would fight others, he would take his sword and quickly cut the Z on their shirts without hurting them, apparently. And I just thought he was wonderful. So my mother got me a Zorro lunchbox. And I took it to school. I think I was in like the first grade or something. I was so excited because I thought, when people see me with my lunchbox, my Zorro lunchbox, they will think I am so cool. I'm such a wonderful kid. They'll look at me with those loving eyes of my mother, you know. When it was time for us to eat our lunch, the way it worked was we all had our lunches in the coat room, our lunch boxes. And when it was time to eat lunch, the teacher would say, "All right, children, it's lunchtime." And we would all neatly go in a row into the coat room and get our lunch boxes and bring them in. And they used to spread on the tables a kind of cloth called oilcloth to protect the tables. So then we'd all open our lunch boxes. So anyway, I was walking from the coat room to the table with my lunchbox, and suddenly everybody started laughing at me. And I turned around, and my thermos, there was a thermos of milk in my lunchbox, was leaking milk. And it had left a trail of milk everywhere I had gone. And the kids were watching me walk and leave a trail of milk, and basically they were laughing. It makes perfect sense. But I turned around and I saw this, and I was so mortified. I mean, I was just like, I was totally abashed, right? Because I was supposed to be Zorro, not a clown who was leaving a trail of milk, you know. And it took all the fun out of my Zorro lunch pail, you know. So this is a kind of thing that happens to us, right? You know, and we begin to behave in ways that are designed to prevent that kind of an embarrassment, right? And we're always looking, I think, for that loving gaze from our mother or maybe our father, you know. And we're looking for that loving gaze in the eyes of others too, you know. What can happen to us is that we get caught up in constantly searching for that, you know, that approval, and sort of like constantly watching ourselves being watched by others, you know. I definitely think this becomes a very powerful force in our lives, you know. So instead of saying, "What would I like to do?" You know, we often say, what will win me the approval of that, you know, what will get me something like the beautiful face of my mother looking at me with love, you know? And so I think we get very confused about what we really want or who we really are. You know, our motives, all of this makes like a lot of sense, you know? But finally, you know, we can become, this can have very destructive effects. You know, so for example, and I hate to bring it up, but, you know, the president, our coming president, is clearly somebody who has, you know, some kind of a personality disorder. And it's very clear that he feels most real when other people, lots of other people, are paying attention to him. And I have known many people like that. I mean, those sorts of people are quite common. You know, and in some ways, we're all a little bit like that. You know, we're all a little bit like that. You know, it's part of developing as a human being is looking to other people for approval and acceptance. And sort of constantly watching ourselves to win that approval or imagining how we're looking to other people. But this, it doesn't take, you don't have to think too hard to see that this can become like a terrific, terrific prison. You know, so it becomes very hard if that's how you're living your life to do anything that's truly spontaneous, you know? Because the risks of disapproval are so great. You know, the risks of disapproval are so great. Or, you know, I'm sure you have countless stories like this, right? You know, where, you know, you as a maybe an adolescent or as a kid, you know, you wanted something to be the case. You wanted all the kids to like you and they didn't like you. Everybody's been on the baseball field. If you're a boy, you've been on the baseball field. And if you're a boy of my generation, you know, there's a high fly ball, and you put up your glove, and you drop the ball. You know, that happens, and it's a terrible moment, and nobody likes to have that moment. So you know, we live a lot of our lives trying never to have that moment. It's very difficult to develop ability to say, yeah, I dropped the ball, it's okay. You know, it's okay. You know, everybody drops the ball, you know. You know, that's very difficult, actually, you know. And so this idea of, like, watching yourself, imagining how others are seeing you, is very much connected to this problem of the I, me, me, me. You know, it's not a question of the I being, like, sinful. Or, you know, don't be selfish. That's not the issue. It's a way of interacting with other people, and an unhealthy way of interacting with other people and with yourself. That's this sort of what you could say is, we say self-centered, but it's more complicated. It's not like you're a bad person or you're narcissistic necessarily. Narcissism itself is coming out of this place, which is basically a very good thing. You know, it's a good thing I can say I. It's a good thing I can say me. I loved my mother. I loved being loved by my mother. You know, it's one of the best things that ever happened to me. You know, so that her loving gaze gave me many good things. And even when I was, when I was an adult until she died, I would call her and we would talk, and I would talk about problems, and she would offer me advice, and she would say, oh, you're doing such a good job. It was like, oh, wow, you know, thanks, Mom. You know, wonderful. You know, so that's nothing wrong with that, you know. But this can become unhealthy when we're unable to... when we don't know who we really are, we can't really be spontaneous. You know, that when you leave the house behind and mother's in the house and you go out on the street and you encounter all these different people, what are you going to do then? You know, and you can be very fearful, or you can be constantly trying to, like, control other people's perception of you. And when they don't perceive you in the right way, you can be dejected or fearful. You know, In Baltimore, I used to have to walk from our apartment to our school, and it was a fairly long walk. And in Baltimore, when I was living there, it was like you can tell I'm still traumatized by it. You know, it was a really tough place. And as a little kid, I was really afraid. And I would walk to school, and there were like these bullies, older kids, who would just like see you, and they'd sort of rough you up just to show that they could do it. And I got to be very good at talking my way out of like getting beaten up. You know, I would try to make jokes. I was funny. I was the funny guy. You know, or I would do anything. You know, basically that would sort of distract them and not invite hostility. You know, and that worked. You know, I learned that you could control these people a little bit by saying the things they liked, like, "Oh, what a cool jacket you have," or, you know, "I'd like to be a big bully too when I grow up, you know, so, like you, just a bully just like you." I wouldn't say that, but you know, you learn how to control other people's perceptions, but this is like a very artificial way to live, right? You know, and so, you know, you could say like the early part of Sesshin is it's like leaving, you know, you're now, you've left your mother's house, you know, and now you're wandering out on the street, and it's like, we have all these like repertoire of games we play with other people, roles we play to elicit their respect and their affection, or to avoid getting beaten up, you know, or whatever. And you know, so part of Sesshin is sort of like being alone with our, not just our thoughts, but alone with ourselves, you know. And you have to say, who am I? Who am I other than what the person my mother thinks I am when she looks at me, or so-and-so thinks I am when he looks at me? You know, at Sesshin, we're not supposed to look at each other. You know, we're not supposed to... you know, when you are having a conversation with somebody you know, that's a very complicated interaction, right? Because there's definitely a kind of role-playing that goes on through the whole thing. You know, so, you know, I was talking to an old friend of mine at New Year's. I called him up. He's a lawyer. He lives in Oregon. And we've known each other since we were in college. And it's funny to hear how when we start talking, we fall back into our roles, you know. So I'm sort of like the irreverent hippie, and he's the you know, the guy who's got 2 feet on the ground. He's the pragmatist, right? You know, so we're playing this role for 50 years or something, you know, 40 years anyway. And if we fall right back into it, you know, it's very artificial, you know. But we actually enjoy it. It's like touching base. Oh yes, you know. But I you know, he's not really the stodgy pragmatist, and I'm not really the entirely the irreverent hippie. You know? So who am I if I'm not those things? You know. So part of Zen practice is having a different relationship to yourself, you know. And you know, day one of Sesshin, you could say, is to practice Zen, is to study the self. And maybe a little bit of untangling. You know, we get so tangled up in all these games we play, these games of self with other people, trying to get their respect and affection. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there's nothing wrong with wanting somebody to like you. There's nothing wrong, that's not phony, right? It's not phony. But it can become a prison if you're unable to get in, you know, unable to put that aside and open up to things a little bit, right? You know, If you feel compelled to play the irreverent hippie all your life, you know, there's more to being alive than that, you know. So when we say I, you know, we're often saying something that is really unclear. You know, who am I? you know, who am I really? You know, it's a big question. And being able to be present with the moment in a truly spontaneous way and in an open way requires us not to fall back into those stereotype roles we've been playing all our life. There is real possibility of spontaneous interaction with the world, you know, of real open-hearted interaction. And it generally requires us to be willing to be like a fool or wrong or absurd, you know. It's generally the case that, you know, if we're so afraid of making mistakes, or we're so afraid of looking like an idiot, you know, that really boxes us in. You know, you, generally speaking, creative people who are living life have moments where they're absurd, you know, and it's wonderful to see people who aren't afraid of that, you know. It's okay, you know, it's okay to be a little bit absurd, you know. So this koan is almost too obvious in a way. When Yangshan Huizhi was residing in Dongping, a letter and a mirror arrived from Guishan Lingyu. So, you know, basically, this is one Zen master making a joke to another Zen master and saying, you know, I'm sending you a letter and I'm sending you a mirror. Right. This is like, this is, you know, basically, are you going to, can you receive my communication? Or are your, is your fear about your identity, about, you know, your, are you a prisoner of these games of self that you've been playing? And so Yangshan ascended the high seat and received the letter. Then holding up the mirror, he said to the assembly monks, "This mirror comes from Guishan. Tell me, is it Guishan's mirror or is it mine? Yeah. Who am I? Where do I begin, and where does Guishan end? You know, am I me? Is the image in the mirror me? You know, where's the real me? If you say it's Guishan's, you say, well, it's not your mirror. Guishan sent it to you. It's in your hands. If you can say something, I'll spare the mirror. If you can't, I'll smash it. And he repeated this three times, but no one in the assembly responded. Then the master smashed the mirror. Well, you know, I think in a certain way, we have to smash the mirror. You know, part of this first couple of days of Sesshin is smashing the mirror. You don't really smash anything, and please don't smash any mirrors. But you have to, you know, it's important to liberate ourselves from these roles we have been playing. These stereotypical roles prevent us from responding creatively and spontaneously to life. You know, I've told this story before, but one of the Zen teachers I practiced with once gave me a koan, and he said, I think the koan was one he made up. It had been raining a lot, and he said, "Your koan is the voice of the raindrops." And I spent the whole day listening to the sound of rain falling in deep samadhi. And then when I had the opportunity to go into Dokusan, I said to the teacher, "I am the sound of the raindrops. I am the raindrops. I am the sound of the raindrops. I am." And he said, "That's a pretty good answer, but it's not the best answer." And I said, "Well, what's a better answer?" And he stood up, and he ran around the Dokusan room going, "Pshhh." And I thought, God damn it! That is a much better answer. But I couldn't smash the mirror, you know? I was too self-conscious. Why the hell didn't I do that? When he did it, I realized I wanted to do that, you know? But I thought, then I will have milk trailing out of the back of my Zorro milk box and people will laugh at me, you know? Why is the milk box, you know, I mean, the lunch box is still there, you know? I felt such regret, because I could have had such a damn good time. I would have felt so good to jump up and do that. And I was, you know, basically unwilling to smash the mirror, you know? So I gave him a safer answer. It's a politically correct answer. I am the rain. Yes, it's Zen. We know you are the rain. But can you really be the rain? Now, can you be the rain? I was still carrying that lunchbox with me, you know. What if I do this and he laughs at me, right? Oh my God, you know. But oh, it would have been so great. So this is what Yangshan is talking about. Monks, this mirror comes from Guishan. Tell me, is it Guishan's mirror or is it mine? You know, where do you start? Where are you? You? Are you your mother? Or, you know, who are you? If you say it's mine, still it was sent by Guishan. If you say it's Guishan's, it's here in my hands. If you say something, I'll spare the mirror. If you can't, I'll smash it. He repeated this 3 times and no one answered. So he smashed the mirror. One of his students, or another Zen teacher, Wu Zhu, Shijie, answered in place of the assembly, I would have said, Master, please try to explain your meaning a bit more clearly. Then I would have smashed it. So we all have to sort of like smash the mirror today and tomorrow. To practice Zen is to study the self. That's day one and day two, generally speaking. To study the self is to forget the self. You see, to smash the mirror. And when you smash the mirror, you can become one with the 10,000 things. You'll never become one with the 10,000 things if you're worried about people laughing at you because your lunchbox is dripping milk. It's a totally human thing. It takes a lot of zazen to get free from that, but we can do it. So please keep up the good work.